The hard part with this business is because the margins, as you talked about, are relatively lower, let's say, as opposed to a beauty company, right? You have to be able to move quicker and you have to be able to move faster and test faster.
Welcome to Drinks Insider, the podcast that's interested in everything you can drink. If it's legal, if you can sell it, and more importantly, if you can make money from it, then we're going to talk about it. So come on this journey into the commercial world of everything drinkable. I'm your host, Felicity Carter, and you're listening to Drinks Insider. In November 2022, a company called Wink filed for bankruptcy. Wink was created as a direct-to-consumer online wine platform that tried to convince people to buy wine thanks to its data-driven personalized recommendations and flexible memberships. It also, of course, offered the convenience of home delivery. Calling itself the internet's number one way to wine, the founders were so confident in the model, they took it public. But the business turned out to be tougher than they realized. For many, wine is just an impulse buy rather than a regular purchase, and the shipping costs were a killer. So for many, the collapse of Wink sounded the death knell for wine DTC in the US. Not so fast, according to Neha Kumar. She has a background in finance and was the COO and CFO of Create and Cultivate, an online platform and conference for female entrepreneurs that was acquired by private equity. In 2023, she co-founded Full Glass Wine Company, which is, quote, a brand acquisition and management firm laser-focused on the DTC wine space. Full Glass Wine has acquired not just Wink, but Wine Insiders and Bright Cellars, and has secured a $14 million Series A funding round. And all of this in one of the toughest times in years to raise finance. In this episode, she talks about how she did it and why she believes in both wine and wine DTC. For anybody who's cynical about wine's prospects right now, it's worth listening to somebody who's clearly very optimistic. Neha, you are a serial entrepreneur and you created or co-created New Money Ventures and Create and Cultivate. Can you tell me what they were and how you did that?
Absolutely. So Create and Cultivate, I was there first. Create and Cultivate is a phenomenal media events platform. And I actually had the opportunity to join that company. It was created by the founder, Jacqueline Johnson. And I joined the company to really help scale the company and get the company to a place of acquisition. And it was a phenomenal journey because we also had the company during COVID, which I'm sure you can imagine was definitely an interesting time in the market for an events media company. Having said that, we were able to successfully get the company sold for an all-cash deal in March of 2021. After that, the founder and I ended up leaving, and we ended up creating our Fund One for New Money Ventures, where we invested in predominantly consumer product good companies, that really had the mission of either serving a strong female demographic or were run or founded by women. And so that was definitely a great, great time.
Because you've got a background in banking, I understand. Is that right?
Yes, you've definitely done your research.
I read all about the umbrella story. Yes. You have to talk about the umbrella story. But before we get to the umbrella story, so when you start something like a fund, where do you get the money from?
So we ended up getting the fund from a single family office, and it was a really interesting time. And, you know, the fun thing about the story is that a lot of times in life, we think that we put efforts towards something and they might not go somewhere. What actually ended up happening is while we were going through the transaction for Create and Cultivate, we actually had a family office that was interested in our business and they were looking to acquire the company. It didn't work out. We spent a lot of time and effort into doing the diligence work with them and cultivating a relationship there as well. And I was also pregnant and with my second child at the time. And it was also peak COVID time, right? So this is September, October, November of 2020. And so I remember when things didn't work out, I felt like I got sucker punched in the stomach, as the entrepreneurial journey always has its ups and downs. But, you know, after we ended up closing the transaction for Create and Cultivate with a private equity firm, some months later, we went back to the family office and we said, listen, we really want to do a fund. We really want to do something. And they said, okay, great. And start to finish in 3 weeks, they fully funded us with a $20 million check.
Wow. That's amazing. Okay. So yeah, that's fantastic. Well, they must have a lot of confidence in you. Let's go back to how you got into banking. Can you tell the umbrella story, please?
I love that you heard that. You know, and I just think it's so interesting because life is full of so many different, you know, serendipitous points. And when we act on things in life, it really makes a big difference. And so I was in a business school at the time. I was at USC Marshall, and we have a bunch of different events that occur, different types of sessions that occur for business school students at the full-time program. And I remember I was going to a session, and it was down the hall that I had to go, and it was raining outside. And the thing is that our parking lot where we have to park, Felicity, is you have to go outside across the street and then go to the parking lot. So if it starts to rain and you don't have an umbrella, you're just kind of SOL. I ended up hearing from some people that there was a session going on for Bank of America where they had shot skis that were umbrellas. So I ran over there before going to my session, and I ended up going to grab one of the umbrellas. And then right there, one of the bankers came by me and he said, "Oh, hey, so, you know, are you interested in Bank of America? What's going on?" And Felicity, I sat there going, oh my gosh, I was like 25 years old. And I said, you know, this is really great. I'm very interested, but I really just wanted the umbrella. And I said, listen, I have to run.
You just wanted the umbrella? Did you tell the guy?
No, I was thinking that.
Oh, right.
I was absolutely thinking that. And I ended up telling him, you know, I'm very interested, you know, and I'm sitting here thinking, I just want the umbrella. And he said, I told him I have to run though, but I'm very interested in this banking program that you have. And he said, you know what? Let me give you my card. Let me get your card. And this is the time, Felicity, all of us had our cards on hand in business school. And so I handed him my card and he said, I'm going to get you our slides. I'm going to get you our deck. I'm going to get you all of our information and would love to share these things with you. And then he also handed me a bunch of the pamphlets and everything else that they had. I ended up, Felicity, taking that material and just lumping it with everything else. And then I ended up looking into that program later, and then I did get very interested. The thing is, I would have never thought about a position that was something like that. And that was a straddling of commercial banking and investment banking. It was working with companies that are looking to do an IPO or looking to get acquired within the next couple of years. And it's so funny in life how when you go out there, if you just act and you get out there, what types of things can occur. And I cannot believe you actually knew about that umbrella story, which is really interesting and amazing.
Well, you know, it starts with an umbrella and it goes all the way to $20 million. That's a pretty serendipitous meeting. So speaking of serendipity, how did you get interested in wine?
You know, when I was, wine is just such a fun, amazing product. And, you know, growing up, I'd always drink some wine here and there, but my love for wine was really cultivated. I'll say it was back in 2014, 15. And I actually remember I was in the south of France and I was there with someone else. His first name is Rudolf. And he said, you know, you really have to learn to live and enjoy the wine. And he started to talk a lot about wine to a couple of my friends and I. And he started to talk about wine and how wine is so dynamic. So wine, when you open a bottle of wine, it's different from the moment that you open it to 5 minutes later to an hour later. And even if you take a bottle of wine, it ages over time and it's different. If you look at other alcohol like vodka is the same when you open it versus later, right? But wine is dynamic. It's living and it's breathing. And he was talking to us. I'll never forget that. The way he was talking about the wine and how inspired he was and he got while talking about the product. And he kept telling us wine is dynamic and it changes over time. And then he said, it's just like human beings. We as human beings are constantly evolving and changing. We're learning in life and we're constantly growing. And wine is that way as well. Wine is alive and it's breathing. And for me at that moment, I remember a shift mentally coming in. Depending on when the wine was made, how it was made, you almost can create now a soul and essence of that product. And also the vehicle in which you consume that product, the type of glasses you use, the time of the day that you're drinking it, the people that you're drinking it with. It is a very social community type of a product. Even if you're drinking the wine by yourself, there is a soul and an essence that comes with the product. I ended up working in wine. It's very serendipitous how that occurred as well.
Can I just ask you, when was the trip to the south of France? When was that moment?
I'd say 2013 or 2014.
Okay, so it's about a decade ago. Yeah.
Yeah. It was a good amount of time and gone out there a couple times since then, but the person, I'll never forget him talking through about just the how dynamic wine is and how it is like human beings.
Okay, so wine is all of those things, but it is also, when you look at it as an industry, it's a very difficult, low margin, fragmented, crowded, oversupplied industry. So how did you go from working with, with really large amounts of money and very dynamic businesses from that moment to getting into wine now as a business?
Absolutely. Felicity, you know, I actually worked at a company called Drinks.com a long time ago. Mm-hmm. And Drinks.com does the direct-to-consumer wine company. And so I was there in 2016 to 2018, 19, to the end of 2018, I believe it was. So I was there for a few years. That's where I really got in and got my feet wet into understanding mm-hmm. and learning about the operation side of the business. And so it truly was everything about shipping, everything about compliance, all the fun things with zone skipping and everything that comes in between and really learning the industry. I teach accounting. So I teach managerial accounting and finance over at UCLA. And one of the biggest things when we're dealing with managerial accounting is understanding product unit costs and everything that is associated around that to ensure that the business that you have is ultimately profitable. So for me, when I was working at Drinks.com, really getting my hands into and understanding everything from the sourcing, distribution, everything that we had to deal with on the shipping side was a very, very big proponent in me getting to understand the industry. Now, fast forward some years later, it's opportunity, right? It's serendipity. And we were essentially looking through at some of the things that were going in the market because we anticipated there to be, me and a couple other people anticipated there to be a lot of consolidation. And one of the industries that we were specifically looking at was direct-to-consumer wine. You have some phenomenal brands that really made some great traction in the market, and that also had the ability to be able to go out there and really grow their customer base and create a lot of brand affinity with the consumers out there. What if we could take a lot of those companies, put them together under one roof, and consolidate a lot of the operations and even certain things from a marketing standpoint, not a brand, but a marketing standpoint when you're talking about marketing optimization? So think of SMS, email, et cetera. Mm-hmm. What if we could put those under one roof? Separate out the brands to ensure that they can create and keep their own identity and really create scale. As you and all of your listeners know as well, when you're dealing with compliance, every time you have a new label, it has to get approved in every single state, mm-hmm. right? And it's a process that you have to go through. And so for new companies that have been coming up, new direct-to-consumer wine companies, it is a challenge to do all of those things. And there's a very steep learning curve in this industry. I know every industry says that they're unique, they're different, but direct-to-consumer wine really is wine and... It really is. And
okay, so you were saying it is different.
It is. It is very different. And there's a very steep learning curve when it comes to this type of a product and then also this type of an industry. And again, as you know, here in this space, there's also a very big nuance with direct-to-consumer versus retail. The rules, the regulations, everything else are very nuanced versus if you're dealing with, let's say, another product that you're in the beauty space, right? In the beauty space, you'll see a lot of companies will go, they'll go direct to consumer first, they'll test it, and then they'll go into a Sephora or an Ulta. In our world, direct to consumer is not a test, right?
That's right.
Direct to consumer is its own business. as opposed to retail, is its own business as well.
Okay, so you're working for Drinks.com. What led you to do what you're doing now? And can you describe what you're doing? You've got three separate companies now. You've got Wine Insiders, Wink, and Bright Cellars. Can you talk about how you went from Drinks.com to what you've got now?
Yes, of course. And so from Drinks.com, we ended up internally, the company was splitting off in between a technology and a direct-to-consumer wine company.
Okay.
For me at that moment in time, I was looking to get a company towards an exit. And so the company was still doing a lot of different things internally. And so I ended up leaving the company. And then I knew the shareholders at the company, Create and Cultivate, they brought me on board to the company so that we could scale that company. And so I was at Create and Cultivate for the next couple of years. After that, Jacqueline and I had the fund for New Money Ventures, fully deployed in January of 2020. Let's see, it's 2022. And that was just around the time, a couple months prior, that Wink had filed for bankruptcy. And so we ended up seeing that there was a lot of change going on in the direct-to-consumer wine space, and this could be a very great time. And it's a fun story. But so the co-founder of Drinks, his name is Louis Amoroso. Louis Amoroso is actually also the co-founder of Goose Island, and then mm-hmm. which he sold to Anheuser-Busch. And then he was also the co-founder of Beverage Solutions, which he sold to Direct Wines. Him and I worked very closely at Drinks, and every year, the next 6-7 years, we'd meet up once or twice a year. He lives in Chicago. We meet up for drinks or go for lunch or something like that. And every time I would tell him, we're going to work again together. We're going to work again together as a team one day. And honestly, Felicity, he would laugh at me a bit, right? He'd be like, yeah, sure, it's going to happen. When Wink had filed for bankruptcy, I ended up giving him a call. And we ended up starting to talk through these items. And we started to say, listen, some of these companies have a really great, strong brands. They have really good product. And is there a way that we could put all of these things, these companies together under one roof and really help them from an operational expertise standpoint and give that injection and that fuel into these brands to really help them take off in a different way? And so it was just opportunity. It was timing. If somebody were to ask me, I teach right at UCLA, and I have a lot of students who will ask me, did you think you were going to be doing these things 5 years ago, 2 years ago, right? No, I didn't. I've always looked at life as not what do I want to do, but what do I want to do next?
Just talking about Wink, I remember I interviewed one of the founders of Wink back in 2019, and I remember their model was the idea that they were going to use data, and then using data, they would create brands around the data, or they would scale it appropriately. And of course, mm-hmm. they went bankrupt. So is that the model that you're still using, or has that changed? And what attracted you to a company that had actually gone broke, basically?
It's a really good question, right? And there's actually a lot of different factors in here as well. And so part of it is that, you know, the company had gone through different changes in management and leadership over the years. There were a lot of changes. And part of it also just was market dynamics, right? And so the difference for us essentially is we're now taking on these companies that have an extreme amount of data, but right. also Felicity, we have multiple brands. So it's multiple brands between these three companies where we can essentially overlay some of the data. So we can look at the data that we have, let's say in one state, we can look at it across three different brands now, and we can see how different consumer demographics are going to act based on certain things that we put into place. It truly is. Could Wink have probably done that? Maybe. Could we do something like that our own right now if we built our own brands? Maybe. It would just take a really long time. The thing that's so nuanced.
Sorry, can you give me a concrete example of how that would work? Because I'm not quite sure. So you've got these three different companies, you've got the data, you've got different states. So in terms of product, how do you match the product to the place?
So it's not necessarily, Felicity, about matching the product to the place. It's more about taking the data and actually looking at each market. Here, let me try this. If you have the difference with this type of a group essentially is that if you have, let's say, so normally in statistics and data, right, you say that you need 100 users to look at something, mm-hmm. right? So even in 100, you should have enough of a sample size. The challenge is that because of the way the market conditions can change so fast and the consumer behavior can go, you need to actually look at a larger sample size. The larger sample size allows you to see changes that can occur. Let's say, for example, price elasticity, right? If you want to go out and test out price elasticity, if you do it normally with 100 people, there's a certain type of assumption that you can make. If you're looking at it across three different types of consumers within, let's just say, the same state, now you can get a better indicator of how consumers are going to behave and what different types of marketing campaigns you could possibly test and put in. So if I want to put in a higher priced product, how is that going to work with a certain demographic based on, for example, how far the average consumer is in a certain state from a wholesale, let's say a Total Wine or something else like that.
Right.
Okay. I think, does that make sense? I think if some of these companies, the hard part with this business is because the margins, as you talked about, are relatively lower, let's say, as opposed to a beauty company, right? Mm-hmm. You have to be able to move quicker and you have to be able to move faster and test faster. By putting a group of these companies together, we now have the ability to essentially take larger amounts of data to test quicker and move faster. And that's what makes the big difference.
So when you say test, do you mean in the sense that you can roll out brands quicker or you can roll out products quicker, that you can see a market opportunity and you can respond really quickly?
It would be the latter. So right. It's more of the roll out the products quicker. Correct. So if we want to take Wing, for example, and we want to put a new proprietary wine in place and we want to test it with some of the demographic, we can do that. Now, everyone's thought process automatically comes towards marketing, but a lot of it also, Felicity, is on the operational side, right? So some of these companies in the past had situations where they would do three bottles on a monthly basis. What can we essentially do to move this up to something that is better for us, but then also better for the consumer? Now, for the consumer, if they have a pack size, let's say 6 or 12, right, it's coming to them with a less frequency. We have more time to curate the packs, and we can also pass on the additional cost savings now to the customer. So what we have the ability to do with a larger amount is we can move, again, a larger amount of data is you get better understanding of how something can move the needle with them.
Okay. So with the three different companies, I assume you've got three different demographics that they each appeal to. Okay. So just say I'm a consumer who's in, I don't know, South Carolina, and I've decided I want to, you know, order wine online. I don't want to go to Total Wine anymore. It's for whatever reason. So what's my first interaction with your company and how does it work? How flexible are you? What can I expect?
So let's say that you're a new customer coming in. You have the ability to come onto our website. You can take a brief profile quiz, which can start to help you learn. What are your profile? What are your likes? What are your preferences? What are the things that work for you? And then essentially we curate packs and we put them together for you. Part of it is there is a huge factor on convenience. So it is really great for customers who don't want to schlep around a large bottles of wine and bring them over home. The other thing also is that we curate the packs for you, which is very convenient. And then the thing that I love, which a lot of our customers do as well, is it's the discovery component. Because there are certain products that maybe you would not have thought that you would like. But when you get the opportunity to try some of them, you know, it can start to expand your profile. You can start to see if there's something else that you might like to try after that as well.
Okay. So one of the big things, I mean, I'm outside the United States and I'm always blown away by how complicated it is. How do you fulfill when you've got three different companies? Do you put all of the wine in one place? Do you have it in lots of warehouses in lots of different states? How do you actually work at the back end?
So we actually have three different warehouses, and that was one of the things as well. So when we were dealing with Wink was in two different warehouses. We moved them over to three. The reason that we moved them over into these warehouses is because it allows us to just serve our customers more efficiently because they can get the products quicker, which is the big thing. It also allows us to evenly distribute the product on the back end. A lot of direct-to-consumer wine is inventory management, as you probably know, and most people know in direct-to-consumer wine, because If you're getting a red shirt from a warehouse, you're getting one red shirt. If you're getting six bottles of wine, you constantly want to pick. Right? So Wine Insiders, for example, for us is a transactional product. Transactional product means it's not subscription versus Bright Sellers and Wink are subscription products. So we have to make sure at any given point in time that our product is evenly distributed amongst our different warehouses, which is a big challenge. Mm. It is not an easy task to do.
So if I sign up for Bright Sellers, am I also a customer of the other two? Like if they have something I need, or, you know, how does that work from a branding point of view?
So at this point in time right now, we currently have them separate, but the ultimate goal here is to move towards what we call the Gap model, which is you have something that is like an Old Navy, a Gap, Banana Republic. So you have different types of consumers that you can have there. Now, absolutely, we would love for it to be that people are coming to Full Glass Wine and that they have the ability to buy products from different places. And that is something that we're currently working on the back end from a technology standpoint. And it isn't just that, Felicity. It's also the fact that we were just talking about with wine, it is a dynamic product. And our profile, our preferences, our taste also changes over time.
Yeah.
And what we would love for us and to give the consumer a better experience by knowing our back end, our operations, and having familiarity with our systems is we're really looking at the consumer life cycle. So when you come in, you might say, not you, but the general you, somebody might say, listen, I just want to quickly get some wines because I have a get together and I just don't want to have to go to the store and I have to pick them because that's a lot of pressure. So you can come onto our website. We'll curate pack for you and send it over and you have it nicely delivered to your home within a couple of days. Now, let's say that person says over time, wine is something I really enjoy and I want to take the time to get to learn these different flavor profiles. I want to get tasting notes with it. I want to know what I can pair these wines with. Then ideally they move into something, let's say like a Bright Sellers, right?
Right.
The Bright Sellers consumer demographic is very big. It's a little bit more of a sophisticated group. They really want to enjoy the wine, live the wine, breathe the wine, which is a fun process. Now, let's say over time, we have some fun, interesting things in the pipeline. I can't share everything yet, but they will be out there in the next so many months. But essentially for us, now let's say the Bright Sellers consumer says, listen, this is great, but I have somebody coming in. My mother-in-law is coming in and she's a big wine person and I really want to impress her. So I want to have the chance on a one-off instance to get one very high-end bottle of wine. What can I do? Right now, the market is so segregated. So depending on the type of product and also the type of experience you're looking for, you have to go to multiple different places. What we're looking to truly build here is a one-stop shop for wine lovers. So it's great for the consumer, and then it's also great for us as a business.
Okay. So do you have any idea at the moment of, because you're actually quite a new, you know, all of this is quite recent. So what do you know so far about your consumers? Who are they and who belongs to which company?
So we have three different brands. So we have Wine Insiders, Wink, and Bright Sellers. So let's talk a little bit on each one of them. And then Wink essentially is the one that we acquired first. And a lot of people are also very familiar with Wink because a lot of the brand awareness and brand work that they ended up doing. And Wink truly in the marketplace has been an innovator in winemaking. They're very respected nationally. They have created modern, approachable, what I would really consider high quality wines that really are accessible. Now, their demographic is primarily a Gen Z millennial. It truly are females that are really out there purchasing wine from a brand that they perceive. Part of it is image-based, status-based, but also has a little bit more of a lively, social, in-touch type of a presentation. And that truly is Wink. Bright Sellers, also another subscription-based company in the company that we just acquired, they all start off with, and this is what I was just telling you about, but they all start off with a personalized taste quiz. the purpose of that is to allow them over time to get a more higher curated pack of wines for their preferences, but also allow them for the option of discovery, which is definitely a lot of fun. This brand does appeal, the demographic is more of the regular wine drinkers, I would say, and those looking for a lasting experience with wine through a subscription, where someone is really doing more of the heavy lifting on the curation for them. Wine Insiders is mostly a transactional product, so it's non-subscription based. And it is a bit more of a seasoned demographic, I would say, and there are people who really want to experience a variety of wines. So you're going to see also there's a lot of world wine pack. So we have wines from New Zealand, we have wines from Australia, obviously a lot from Italy and France as well. But it really is people that want to try a different type of a product, or different types of wines, varietals, especially also from all over the world. Wine Insiders does appeal to really a gender neutral demographic. And they are, again, purchasing transactionally in higher volumes. When we were doing diligence on these companies and assessing them internally, we were playing an over under game because there were a lot of people who would automatically assume, especially in something like Bright Cellars and Wink, that there's a huge overlap in the customer demographic. It was actually very, very low. It was less than 5%.
Interesting. I mean, one of the things that Wink did get right is they were very good at spotting trends. Like I remember very early on they were into the better for you category, I think before a lot of other people did. So I'll come to trends a little bit later. That's interesting. But okay, so having talked about the consumer, can I ask the wines themselves, are these wines that people label so they'll recognize, or are these wines that are unique to you?
So these wines are unique to us. They are private label wines that we make a request from the wineries to produce.
Okay. And do you use the Wink model of, you know, you start with small batches and if it works, then you make a bigger batch, or, you know, how does the winemaking back end model sort of work?
No, I mean, that's just such a great question because it's a mix of different things here on the winemaking side in regards to sourcing the wine. So long story short is, because our volume is so high, it's a mix, right?
Right.
And so we definitely start with a batch. And then if it works, we're going to go larger. We will have some that are going to be more mainstay, what we'll call the anchor brands, the labels that people are going to keep coming back for all three. But a big proponent of this is also variety and discovery.
One of the things that everyone in the industry is talking about now is premiumization. So you can see the big companies like Constellation, for example, Gallo, and they're moving as high, as fast as they possibly can. So what do you sort of offer in terms of the higher-end product, and how easy is higher-end product to sell DTC as opposed to somebody, you know, going and needing advice on choosing it?
At this point in time, we really offer wines that are we consider a little bit more middle of the road today.
Right.
As I told you, we do have some fun things coming up in the pipeline. Having said that, higher end wines are definitely a great type of a product to have. They're wonderful for creating the halo effect for the brands. People do have a strong association for those types of products. Having said that, we're very clear at this point in time who our consumer demographic is, and our consumer demographic isn't today necessarily going out there to go and buy a $500 bottle of wine. They're looking for something that they can really enjoy. They can grow with over time. They're looking at bottles that are anywhere from, let's say, an $8 to $30 price range that is conveniently delivered to them at their home. That is a curated pack.
We'll get on to other things in a second. I'm just really interested in this. So that the $8 price range becomes very difficult for shipping. How do you manage? Because that's another thing I find amazing about the United States is how expensive the shipping is. Like, it's off the charts.
Yeah.
How do you manage to run a good wine business while paying these god awful freight rates?
Absolutely. And that's where, you know, economics, like unit economics is always a fun thing to look at. And I love it because it's math, right? You know, to a certain extent, you know, it's not that these things are binary, but it makes the calculations very easy. And the thing about it is, Felicity, is that if you're looking at these, it's going to be anywhere between that range. So if you're on a subscription plan and if you're getting more wine, so let's say a consumer is buying 12 packs of wine or even a 15 pack of wine. So Wine Insiders, we sell a lot of 15 pack of wines as well. So if people are buying the wine that way, then the per bottle cost can go down for them.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so as a business, the way we make it work is by motivating consumers or giving them an incentive to increase their pack size. For me, the shipping cost is a very important component, as you were just talking about. And so if I can lower down the per unit shipping cost by increasing the ultimate pack size, it's not only better for me, but it's also better for the consumer. And so that's why they're able to get a lower price point per bottle.
Did you just say you sell in packs of 15?
Yes. So Wine Insider sells packs of 15 as well.
Wow, that's so cool. Do you have special boxes or does it come in two boxes?
Yes. No, we have our own boxes.
God, I'd buy 15 if I could. That sounds great. Okay, so now that we're talking about...
I'm going to circle really fast just for fun because I think you'll like this, Felicity. So this is where that data, the overlaying data really makes a difference. So if we start to circulate and triangulate information and we say somebody's in this one state, and then if we notice that all three of our brands, if you layer the data on top of each other, none of them live near a large wine wholesaler, we can start to see that there's certain marketing initiatives that we could possibly push out to certain demographics that are going to encourage higher volume purchasing behavior. And that's something that is really great for us because the biggest thing is shipping.
Right. That's really interesting. I mean, I know about this because every so often I try and send friends of mine bottles of wine to thank them for whatever. And my God, the shipping cost is more than the bottle of wine. And it's not like I'm buying cheap wine. Okay, so let's keep on the topic, the very interesting topic of money. So it's very difficult to raise money at the moment, ever since, you know, interest rates went up. It's very difficult for people to raise money in the wine space. It's very difficult generally. But you've managed to raise $14 million for a wine company. How did you do that? What was the pitch that you made?
I mean, you know, it really is a great idea of what we're putting together. And consolidating these companies and operationalizing not only the finance side. So people always think about back-end operations as finance and accounting, but also really creating a true marketing engine makes such a big difference. And for us, that truly has been it, is really showing and pitching our idea of what we think is important and the areas we want to focus in on, and really having a very strong management team. And truthfully also, it takes a village to make something happen. And our extended team, especially our bankers, were absolutely phenomenal. It makes a big difference having the right people in your corner when you're trying to run a business and do so many different things at once. And when they're supporting you, it is very big.
Well, this is a very, very difficult market. At the moment, we've got an oversupply of wine. We've also got, unfortunately, the consumption is falling. So how are you going to build your customer base in the face of that? And also the fact that at the moment, digital is also really hard. Social media is declining. It's not as effective as it was. SEO is not as effective as it was. So in the face of all of these challenges, how are you going to build your customer base?
The great thing about what we're doing is we acquired the customer basis.
Right. Okay.
So could we have done that anyways on our own? This is what I was saying earlier as well. We could have, it would have just taken a very long time and a lot of money. We were able to essentially go in and acquire these really, really great customer bases that are already there for the brands. And so now it's about making sure that we're looking at, you know, no stone is left uncovered. What are different strategies that we can use? Testing out different price points, looking at different types of models of different plans we can put into place. You know, one of the things that we're doing for one of our brands right now is there's so many variations on one of the clubs that they currently have in place that we're able to essentially consolidate the manner in which the club gets shown to the consumer. But then the actual varietals get a better, higher level of preference in regards to what they're getting in the pack. What that does from the back end side is to manage out every type of a subscription in various different pack sizes actually causes a lot of work and labor on the back end.
Sorry, I'm not quite sure what you meant. You said you've consolidated. Can you go back and explain how that works in practice? Like, pretend I'm a consumer and you need to explain it to me.
Yes. Yes. Well, if you were a consumer, I would essentially tell you, listen, right now there's, so I'd always like, almost like at the In-N-Out model, right? So the reason In-N-Out, are you familiar with In-N-Out by any chance?
No, you have to explain that too.
Okay, so it's a West Coast burger chain, and it is a lot of fun. But the great thing with In-N-Out is that they have three basic packages, right? So you have option 1, 2, and 3. Now there's a little twist that you can do on each one, but the reason In-N-Out, I believe, and we look at it in academia as well, right? And we study cases on it, that is so successful, is that it is so much easier for the human brain to essentially look at something and say, listen, I have three different options and I can make a tweak on each one to get my preferences. If you tell someone you have 100 options, it's almost an analysis paralysis.
That's right. Yes.
And over the years with some of the brands, they created so many options. And the challenge is that from an operational standpoint on the back end, every time you create a new package, we'll call it, like if In-N-Out has three, there's so much work that has to get done on the back end. And then also, you know, the customer service can suffer because the customer service has to constantly be trained to make sure they understand all these different, let's call it 100 different packages, right? By consolidating out, and this is all on an operational standpoint. So if you were a consumer, I would just tell you, simplified the process for you. I've simplified the process for you, and I'm allowing you now the opportunity to, instead of having to figure out our system, we're coming to you with these are the three options, the basic options that are there, but we can make the tweaks based off of your individualized preferences. So again, if I was just talking to a consumer, it would be, we have simplified this for you and we've cleaned it up to make it easier.
Okay, so say for example, I drink lots of New Zealand Sauvignon Blanc, but I'm open to other ideas. How would, you know, what would the service offer me? How would you get me onto some of those other possibilities?
So what we would actually do is on our back end, we would look and see based off of, and this is where the data is really big. So based off of other people who like that as well, what have products been that they have tried that they have ranked highly? And what we would start is, and some of this is a little bit on the proprietary side, but I'm giving you a couple of items here. Then based off of that and this large database that we have, we can now start to share other new products with you so you can go ahead and try them. Now, we do obviously have a guarantee as well. So if there is a wine that someone doesn't like, they do have the ability to say, listen, I tried the wine. It doesn't work for me. Can you send me something different instead? And so all of the brands that we currently have right now do have something that we call a double guarantee.
Right. Okay. So what have you learned about consumer preferences from being engaged in this? Now, I know it's actually all quite recent. So, you know, I know it's an early days question, but what have you learned about consumer preferences?
People love to try new things.
Oh, interesting.
And a lot of times we think that we have a certain palate and we think that I'm just going to be with this palate. But over time, our preferences change also. After I had children, my palate significantly changed. So we have medical things, other things that might come up, and our taste preference and profile does change. And while I've just been at Full Glass Wine, obviously it's been a short period of time. You know, I have been in direct to consumer wine overall for an extended period of time. And wine isn't just a one time or 1 year or 2 year thing. It really is a lifestyle.
So how did your own preferences change after pregnancy?
Oh, I definitely am significantly more sensitive to various types of wine. I've always loved red wines, but sometimes some of the heavier cabs, et cetera, can be a little bit more challenging for me, which is very, very interesting. Also, we have Bright Cellars has a margarita wine.
A margarita
which is
one.
Very, very. Yes,
no, stop right there. You have to tell me about. Popular. You have to tell me about the margarita wine.
We're actually going to have to send you some of the margarita wine.
You
now
are going to
well,
have to send me some. Send me
try.
Lots. Send me a 15-pack. No, but what is the margarita wine?
So it is actually a product that Bride Cellars had put into place. I'm not going to take credit for it, but they wanted to try something a little bit different. They are using full agave in there. And essentially what it is it's a really? Product that you can pour. You can just pour over ice. You open the bottle and you pour over ice. And I was very reluctant to try it. And I did. And it is a very good product. And we're going to have to, I have to figure out the shipping now because you are international, but we are going to have to try to figure out how to get you some products.
Well, yeah, but okay. So it's sort of a crossover wine. Are you doing other crossovers? Like, do you have a bourbon barrel red or, you know, are you going to try something like that now that you've done this?
So at this moment in time, we do not have anything else. But we always are open to thinking of great new ideas that are innovative, that are really going to provide, good options for our customers. So if it is something that our consumers are very, very into and interested, we're never going to take something completely off the table. Again, our goal truly is to be the one-stop shop for wine lovers.
So how do you know what your consumers might be interested in? So let's say something like the bourbon barrel red, which are very, very popular. How would you, you know, at what point do you start introducing new products and on what basis do you introduce them? Do you just look at what's happening in the market and try it? Or is it that people are actively asking for it? Or what's the process?
It's a combination of both of those. And I'm going to add a third one as well is that's our responsibility is to look to see what is going to be up and coming in the next couple of years, right? Tequila has been something that's been very hot for the past so many years. So I'm not going to take the credit for this because this was on Bright Cellars. We acquired the company, so they did a very good job of putting that into play and looking at it. And it has done very well as a product, specifically for that brand, which is amazing. But number one is our consumers are very vocal. The Wink consumers specifically are very vocal about what they like and they don't like, which is wonderful. It's very helpful. The Bright Cellars customers have had periods of time, if we go back and look at all the data, when they've actually raised up their voice a little bit more and saying they like or they don't like something. But part of this also is developing and continuing to develop a relationship. Because remember, we acquired these companies.
Yeah, sure.
But it's continuing to develop a relationship with the consumers where it is a collective, collaborative effort. So the more that they're telling us on what they like and they don't like, the easier it is for us to also curate the process for them. Now, you want to remember...
Hang on. How do they tell you? Is it all social media feedback? Is it by phone? Like, how do you get this feedback from them?
We get it via emails from them.
Oh, okay.
So even if you're looking at the NPS score and the surveys that we do, but you want to remember we're in a fortuitous situation with these types of consumers because they also know that the more that they give feedback on the wines they like, they don't like. So they'll have to star or write comments on the things that they liked or didn't like. So let's say somebody's getting a 6-pack bottle of wine from Bright Cellars. They get the 6-pack bottle of wine from Bright Cellars and then there are 3 or 4 wines that they normally get and 2 wines were a part of the discovery. The only way that we can actually better curate the pack for them is by their feedback.
Okay. So if you've got a margarita wine, I strongly suggest you now need a gin and tonic wine. I encourage all Americans to take up gin and tonic drinking, which I hear that you don't nearly enough. okay. So, Let me change the subject slightly because I don't want to hold you up. We've been talking for ages. On the other side, you've also invested in entrepreneurs. So when you invest in people, what do you look for, and what are the red flags, and what are the things that you go, yes, I'm going to invest in this person or this business?
So the number one thing is, I believe for all people looking to make investments is just being clear on what is your check size and the stage of the company that you're investing in. And so I'm making early stage investments right now on the personal side. And so the biggest thing when you're making an early stage investment is truly looking at the founder and how the founder has the ability to react to constantly changing market conditions. When you're looking at companies that are further established and further along the road, they have the ability to really stand on the infrastructure of the company. The challenge that you have with early stage companies is as the wind blows, the company can change and it has to be able to change and it has to be able to potentially pivot. I truly look for in early stage companies, how is the founder and how is the founding team? And I think that just comes back to the question that you had asked me earlier as well, is how did we go out there and raise?
Yeah.
I think by having the benefit of seeing so many great founders and what we're always learning, right? I teach and I'm also a student for life. And so I've had the great opportunity of seeing so many amazing founders pitch. And I've also, when they're pitching to me, I'm learning from them and how they've pitched really well and what they've done. That's such a good job. And so I used a lot of those strategies when we were pitching. And so the founder is so, so important. The second thing that I really look for, which is, you know, below the founder and the management team, it is the industry profile. So it truly is that type of a product. What industry is it in? And what is the ability for that type of a company to have a liquidation event? And obviously factors that come into place are going to be what were recent acquisitions done in that space? What is the margin profile? There's obviously some companies that have a larger margin profile. When you're looking at beverage companies, and you've, you know, pointed this out a couple times in our conversation right now, but there's certain businesses like ours, which might have a slightly lower margin profile. The way that you're going to make the money, Felicity, on these types of businesses is scale.
Mm.
And so in our business, we had to make sure that we have enough volume with these multiple acquired brands, because that's where the unit economics actually really start to make sense, because you would start to have more leverage. Has a little bit of a negative connotation, but you end up having more, you know, more ability to negotiate also in pricing, right? Which is a phenomenal thing. And so that's where it really starts to make sense. So I would just say founders, and then also the specific industry and what's been happening in that industry is how I look at making investments.
Okay. So are you looking to acquire any more wine DTC or spirits DTC businesses?
We are very opportunistic, and so we're always keeping our eye out for other things that might help us get this company to a great continued place, which will better service our consumers. And so we'll always be keeping our eye out for fun things.
Okay, and final question, where do you think the opportunity is in this market?
For direct-to-consumer wine or?
Yeah, wine generally or direct-to-consumer, whichever opportunity springs to mind first. Where do you think the big opportunity is?
I think the big opportunity in this market right now is via consolidations and roll-ups. You have a lot of great brands across the board in various different industries and a lot of industries where people did a lot of good work. And it's just the way the market works, right? It's a little bit textbook. When interest rates are low, money is freely flowing. Money is freely flowing. People are growing as fast as they can through acquisition. And sometimes they're having to build the plane while flying the plane. And so a lot of times the infrastructure might not have been put into place because they just had to move so fast. And that was because the way competition was for them in the market at that time, because everybody was growing so quickly. Now things have completely flipped. It's a very different market. So for a lot of entrepreneurs out there who have a lot of industry know-how and expertise, I genuinely think looking at consolidation and roll-ups is a phenomenal opportunity. And for the founders of those original companies, it's a great play also to have your brand that you've created and built find a really good home where it can continue to thrive off of an infrastructure that's built in place to truly support it.
Can you just define for me what a roll-up is? Because I actually don't know.
So if you think of what we're doing right now, that's essentially a roll-up. We're taking a few of these brands that we have and we're putting them together, but we're putting them on a common platform. So one of the first things we did with Wink when we bought them is we moved them to the warehouses that we currently wanted in place. Mm-hmm. And then also we moved them onto a new tech platform. They had an internally built platform, and then we moved them onto Shopify. Now, the reason for that is we moved them onto this platform, Shopify. Wine Insiders was on that already, and Bright Cellars had transitioned to them over in the past year. And so now what you can do is you can actually consolidate and look at all the data and get all the reporting in one place. For anyone who has a direct-to-consumer wine company out there, any of your listeners, or if they've ever worked at a direct-to-consumer wine company, everyone knows that getting the data cleaned and organized is not an easy feat. It is not. So once you start to be able to clean it and get it in a way that you can actually do something with that data, it makes a very big difference. And so consolidations and roll-ups is something that are already actively happening in the market, which is the prime time for.
All right. Well, on that positive note, I'm going to say thank you very much. You've given certainly me a lot to think about. And it's been absolutely fantastic speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Felicity. And thank you for all the great research work and everything that you've done to have this call. You're obviously very knowledgeable about the space.
You've been listening to Drinks Insider, the podcast that explores the intersection of beverages and commerce. Now, if you would like a summary of this episode, sign up for the Drinks Insider newsletter, which sends you the takeaways. Just go to drinksinsider.com and add your name. And if there's something you think we should be talking about, drop me a line at felicity@drinksinsider.com. And before you go, please don't forget to rate this podcast. 5 stars are most welcome.